Yeah. Yeah. What? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hello there.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Lavender Fix podcast. I am ridiculously excited about this episode because not many people are aware about the subject matter for today. As you may or may not have guessed by the title of this episode, which reads Afro Hair, Devaluing Black Authenticity for White Comfort. Now, I don't know where you're sitting right now, but I would request you to close your eyes for a couple of minutes. It's 7 a.m. on a Monday. You're still in bed, sleeping like a baby. Suddenly, your alarm goes off. The worst possible sound selection. A rooster crowing. Now you're distraught. So much for setting a positive tone for the day. You drag yourself out of bed. Your hair is still damp from last night's shower. You forgot to wear a shower cap. And now what? Now you're a curly mess. Well, guess what? You have a big presentation in the next 1 hour. What now? Do you have enough time to eat breakfast, change, and most importantly, blow dry and straighten your hair before the meeting? You're anxious, nervous. You've lost your appetite because you barely have enough time to prep your hair for this meeting. You wear your favorite blouse, pajamas remain unchanged, and you look at your presentation one last time as you sip on coffee. You catch a quick glimpse of yourself before hopping on the Zoom call, and you're gripped by panic because you forgot to lay your curls down with a flat iron. My hair. Oh my god, my hair. I should just turn the video off so no one notices or thinks that I'm unkempt. Have you ever been gripped by a panic like that because you felt your hair was too curly and that your curls would be judged as unruly or unprofessional by your colleagues? Or did you just run some product and a diffuser through your hair and show up confidently? Did you slick back your straight tresses and use a scrunchie to tie a bun? Was it a big deal? Problem solved? Well, Black men and women don't feel the same way. For Black women in particular, a hairstyle can often be viewed less as an aesthetic choice than as a political one. And we have many questions. Hair is very essential to the Black identity and is often misunderstood by people outside of the culture. But guess what? Clearing up small misunderstandings about hair can go a long way to clearing up big misunderstandings about race. I would like to welcome back my friend Kimberly Houston from our Black Lives Matter episode to talk about America's fascination with Black hair and why Black men and women have to manage their hair by damaging it for the sake of being perceived as less threatening. Welcome back, Kim. How are you?
I am so well. Thank you so much again, Sabrine, for having me on for this episode.
Of course. Well, I am so excited about this episode, and mostly because I'm curious to learn from you, as always. Right?
Yeah.
And the reason I wanted to chat with you about this topic of hair and context of the Black culture is because of something that happened at my workplace once.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what happened was we were just like, a bunch of colleagues were just chatting in a corner. And then one of our colleagues said to us, I want to show you something on LinkedIn. Can you just hop over to my desk? So me and my other colleague, we went over to our colleague's desk. And then he was basically showing us some examples of posts on LinkedIn because we work in marketing. And I remember that one of our clients had released a major statement or an announcement. And as part of that photo grid, the diversity and equity head of this company happened to be a Black woman, right? And I have met her in person, and she usually styles her hair a certain way. Like, you can tell that there's product. But in this specific photo, I could tell that she's wearing her hair more naturally, right?
Yes.
And so my colleague's first reaction, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't so intentional because it's so deeply ingrained, was, oh my God, is she like allowed to wear her hair like that?
Yeah.
To work, right? And mind you, this was when, we were already social distancing and just before, I guess, before we entered that phase, right? So a lot of people had already started working from home. So I assume that, you know, she had taken this image, whatever was clicked at her home. But still, like, it doesn't matter if it was clicked in a workplace or at home. It's still your hair. It grows naturally out of your head. And so there shouldn't be a question about how you should, you know, whether you should use product or not. So I think that episode left a huge, impression on me. And, that particular episode sparked this huge question in my mind about why it was considered odd for Black men and women to wear their hair naturally, especially if the rest of us have to never justify our hairstyles at work otherwise.
Right.
So what do you think about that, Kim?
Oh, man. Sabreen, you come with the topics.
Yes, always.
I think one of the challenges that I have with these types of conversations, like, I know I was talking to you recently about another, Black Lives Matter type of conversation, mm-hmm. where I made a statement and a gentleman had the audacity to respond to my statement, well, if you don't like it, well, what did he say? Swim back to Africa.
Jeez.
And the challenge with these types of conversations is that when Black people, stand up to call out microaggressions or, affront aggressions,
mm-hmm.
then they're accused of, they're kind of gaslit, right? They're gaslighted. They're told, oh, well, you're being too sensitive. Oh, mm-hmm. Why are you making such a big deal out of what is such a small issue,
right?
And so the issue is constantly minimized, and it makes Black people feel like they don't have the right to voice these opinions and voice their experiences around microaggressions, because when they bring these situations to the forefront, they're being told that they're minor and that Black people shouldn't take them so to heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really appreciate your intentionality around, first of all, noticing, noticing, and for the fact that when your colleague said that to you, it sparked a question for you, like, why would they respond like that?
Right.
Which is the birthplace of this episode. I feel like that's what Black people need in terms of allyship. When we talk about alliance, right? How mm-hmm. non-African-American people can align themselves as allies with African-Americans all around the world, all around the United States and African diaspora all around the world. It's people who are sensitive enough to something so seemingly so small as that reaction and calling it out,
mm-hmm.
And saying, wow, like, why would you respond that way? Or wow, like, why would the way that she's wearing her hair, why should it make a difference versus anybody else? And in order for us to all kind of come to this level of equality, it takes non-Black people to make those types of awarenesses and bring those things to the forefront. Because when Black people do it, we get pinned as complaining or, you know,
aggressive,
being too sensitive, you know, and therefore what people do is they suppress those interactions and they just internalize those environments because they know that in order to get ahead in those spaces, they don't really have much of an other option.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really grateful, you know, that through this podcast and just, you know, the person that you are, it means for people to, like I said, bring these things to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, make sure that those who have these sentiments understand that it's not okay. It's going to help to make them more accountable for what they believe and how they act.
Correct.
And therefore helps to helps the cause for African-Americans and those in the African diaspora.
Right. No, absolutely. I think it's, hair is such a political thing. I also said this in my introduction. And it just makes me feel like, wow, I had no idea that something like this could be such a big deal. Like, why are people even concerned about how a Black person wears their hair? Like, nobody asks us, nobody questions why we have a scrunchie on or not, right? So I was just almost compelled to ask you that. The other thing also is, Kim, that Black people, whether they're young, old, and in between, have, it's proven that they've been rejected from jobs, schools, and other public places because of the texture and style of their hair, right?
Definitely.
And I was doing some research last night, just, you know, going through some facts to make sure that I make sense. And I came across this story from last year. I don't quite remember where this was published, but it was about this little boy named Clinton Stanley Jr. Uh-huh. And who was really excited about his first day at a new private school in suburban Orlando in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And his father thought that, you know, this fancy private academy, you know, Books Christian Academy, with its small class sizes and sort of a rigorous curriculum was the perfect place for a six-year-old, right? But this child never made it inside his first grade classroom. And the father and son arrived only to have an administrator stop them at the entrance and demand that the boy leave to cut his hair. Little boy, right?
Yeah.
And he also cited that this school policy banning dreadlocks, right? And so instances like these make Black hair a very political topic. Right.
Most definitely.
So much so that several states and cities, as you were mentioning yesterday, you know, had to pass or propose laws last year banning policies that penalized people of color for wearing natural curls and dreadlocks, twists, braids, and, you know, other hairstyles that embrace their natural, you know, cultural identity. And Kim, I know we were talking about this when we were discussing the script, but could you share with our listeners a deeper context for why we need to go to the extent of passing legislation for something as basic as the right to wear your hair naturally?
I think your title for this podcast says everything.
That's correct. Right? All thanks to you, by the way. You were the one who picked it. So 10 points to Gryffindor.
The lengths that African descended people have to go to for the sake of white comfort,
mm-hmm.
what it means to assimilate, you know, when we talk about, you know, straightening your hair for Black women, whether it's, you know, using a hot comb in order to straighten your hair, whether it's using chemical products that will straighten your hair for the purpose of deflating the image of Black people as being a threat. Mm-hmm. And so the more that we are assimilating into the white aesthetic, then the idea is that it'll make you more acceptable to white people and more acceptable in white spaces. And I feel like the challenge with that is it doesn't guarantee you acceptance in those spaces. But even just for the possibility of acceptance, you have to go through the process of, you know, damaging your hair through heat damage, mm-hmm. or damaging your scalp through, you know, lye relaxers or no lye relaxers, you know, the possibility of you getting cancer or getting fibroids from, you know, continual use over a chronic amount of time of these different products, just so that you have a shot at being accepted. But the reality is that there's no guarantee of that acceptance, which is the reason why, as you go higher and higher up corporate ladders, you see less and less people of color in those spaces, even though they take all of these measures in order to deflect from their appearance in a hope to be able to be seen for the content of their character, or to be able to be seen for their wits, their intelligence, and their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, it's a really sad thing. I think part of what's happening in Black culture because of it, and because in the Black community, is more people are leaning more towards entrepreneurship, and obviously, you know, technology helps a lot more with those types of endeavors. And you know, even I was watching this video by Beyonce the other day, and she was as all of, you know, presidents and different people in high places this year, because of COVID, made the decision that they were going to address the classes of 2020. And mm-hmm. in Beyonce's address, she really spoke to that whole phenomena where in her career, you know, there were a lot of tables that she was not invited to. And so therefore she yeah. built her own table and is now creating space for people who look like her to, you know, be able to flourish in their gifts, in their talents, and in their professions without having that fear or having that obstacle of the aesthetics, you know. And right. I applaud her and others who are doing similar.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I find that very interesting that, you know, first of all, people of the Black ethnicity, they have a very, it's a routine. It's a rigorous routine. It's not like a one-step process. Right. I shower, I air dry my hair, and that's it. I don't have to apply product. I don't have to go through like a bunch of steps to make sure that I look presentable, or, you know.
Right.
Now, as you said that, you know, Black women, especially, you know, they felt pressured for decades to use excessive heat and chemical relaxers and weaves to sort of conform to European standards of straight hair. Much of the pressure, you know, Black women say has come from employers and school officials who don't view locks or braids as the neat professional hairstyle, which right. is required, or might see that, you know, because they fear that they may be seen as aggressive. Or I read this somewhere yesterday. It was very interesting that if you don't conform to, you know, these unrealistic standards, especially the European standards of straight hair, that it's a signal that the wearer isn't interested in fitting in.
Yeah.
Right? So, like yeah. you said, wearing your Afro hair is a threat, you know?
Yeah.
Because it adds so much to your personality, right? It can't go unnoticed. But my question now is, I mean, yes, there's this aspect of Black people are looking for acceptance, but there's no guarantee. But do you think that there are any other underlying factors for why Black people feel coerced into the idea of fitting in? Is there a lot of pressure even internally from the community members?
Definitely, most definitely. You know, along with the conversation of racism, needs to be addressed the conversation of colorism. And the unfortunate thing about colorism is when you've had racism inflicted on you for so many generations and centuries, then it's only natural for that racism to then become internalized. And the internalization of that racism in the Black community is colorism.
Mm-hmm.
And so colorism is the whole idea that the lighter skinned you are, similar to the caste, right? The lighter skinned that you are, is the more benefits you have in the society, or the more pretty you're seen as being, or the more acceptable you're seen as being.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that that manifests, like for instance, in the South, is you'll hear a lot of people refer to lighter skinned Black people as red boned, right? Or yellow skinned girl. Like I know my family's from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, mm-hmm. and they talk about that a lot. Like my grandmother, who, you know, is really light skinned, her mother was half white. And so she said that yeah. they would refer to her as onion colored,
uh-huh.
You know, her nickname, interestingly enough, the name that she affectionately goes by is Shirley. And the way that she got that name is because when she was a child, she was really light-skinned with red hair. And so they nicknamed her Shirley after Shirley Temple. Uh-huh. And so, you know, all through the diaspora, you see these examples of how, like I said, the systematic racism of white people. I mean, even if you look from slavery times, right? The half-breed, you know, descendants or the half-breed children of the slave and the master were usually the ones that got to work inside the house. They weren't put in the fields. Mm-hmm. And so that even created a negative rivalry on plantations because the lighter skinned, quote unquote, Negroes got to do what they considered less hard work, which was working in the house, serving, you know, as servants, as maids, as nannies, as those types of things. And they worked in the house while the darker slaves, the darker skinned slaves worked the fields and did all of the hard manual labor. And so that history still carries itself out in our communities through colorism.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that, you know, this constant belittling by the white community has somehow been internalized by the black community, which is essentially leading to self-hate of some form?
Definitely, definitely. One of the most egregious arguments, right? Oh, Jesus. One of the most egregious arguments that happens in our United States of America when we have conversations about racism and when we talk about racist white people killing or attacking black people is they constantly like to deflect by saying, well, what about black on black crime? Well, what about, you know, gang violence in black communities?
Mm-hmm.
And what they're not understanding is what they are pointing to in gang violence in black communities and black on black crime is a snowball effect, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, you know, how many centuries ago, white people, they started the snowball, right? They started the snowball through systematic racism. They started the snowball through, you know, the slave trade, through slavery. And now this snowball is rolling, 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 yeah. right? And so as we know, right, the snowball, as it continues to roll down the hill, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And unfortunately, now you have hated a people so much that now they hate themselves, right? Now they don't like the fact that they have big noses. They get a little bit of money and they go and they get plastic surgery mm-hmm. to make their nose a little bit straighter, right? To make their lips a little less pronounced, right? And to get their skin lightened. I mean, even that's a big thing among the African diaspora of, you know, people who come into money. And then next thing you know, you see one picture of them and they have their beautiful melanated skin. And then you see another picture of them and then they look like a ghost
mm-hmm.
because it's been ingrained over centuries in the culture that whiter skin is better, lighter skin is better, hair that doesn't have as much curl, right? The looser that your curl is or the straighter that your hair is, then you have good hair. Right. Quote unquote, mm-hmm. good hair versus, you know, the tighter your curl is, then, you know, you have bad hair or they want to call it N-word naps. Right. Mm-hmm. And those are the derogatory things that over centuries and centuries of, you know, whiteness being the standard and long, stringy, light colored hair being the standard, then they internalize that they are bad.
Yeah.
There was even an experiment that was done. Oh my goodness. This experiment was done, I believe, in either the 80s, 70s or 80s, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, where they took a doll. They took two dolls and they showed them to a little black girl. And they asked her, which doll is the pretty doll? Which doll is the good doll? You know, and they asked them all these terms. And in all cases, they would point to the white doll as being the pretty doll, the white doll as being the good doll, the white doll as being the nice doll.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you look in pop culture, right, and you look at television and you look at how many people of color are you seeing on television? How are people of color depicted on television? Mm-hmm. How are people, you know, Caucasian people depicted on television? So if you're as an African-American person or as a person from the diaspora are watching television and all you're seeing is the good people, the helpful people, the kind people, the successful people, right? The monetarily successful people are white. Then mm-hmm. subconsciously you start to internalize that that's what's right and that's what's good. And you also start to internalize that because you're not that, you're not good. You're not, you don't have the ability to be wealthy. all of these things get subconsciously programmed into your mind based on the systematic racism that exists, you know, all the way through.
Right. So, Kim, statement, this is going to be more of a statement than a question. So, actually, it is going to be a question. Does banning ethnic hairstyles uphold this notion of white supremacy?
Definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Because when you ban ethnic hairstyles, you stifle diversity.
Right.
Period. You know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's across the board, right? I mean, African Americans and people of African descent are not the only ones whose cultures are very steeped in the way that we do our hair. You know, when you study history, all different nationalities and cultures have some type of cultural significance in hair. And so when you say, oh, you have to have a slick back ponytail in order to look professional, then that means that only people who have ease to do that can be successful, or they can be successful without as much work and effort.
Mm.
And so that goes into the whole idea of privilege. Now, imagine if it was flipped, right? Imagine if we said that the definition of success was an Afro.
Mm-hmm.
And every single Caucasian person or other person who did not have a tightly coiled Afro would have to go to a salon and get a perm and come out looking like a poodle mm-hmm. in order to be successful.
Right.
Now, I know I have friends who are white, and I have seen and heard about how much hairdressing appointments can cost.
Yep.
Right? For simple things. So imagine if they had to go to that extent, and then if you have hair that grows very often, so every time you have new growth, you had to go and get that process redone, and mm-hmm. then only God knows the damage that that would do to your hair because you want to appear assimilatable, right?
Right.
To somebody in power, and so therefore those were the measures that you had to take in order to be accepted.
Right. And it's so extreme where I know I gave this example to you yesterday where I was, you know, referring to what happened at my workplace. You know, what if having a certain sort of a nose or the shape of your nose had to be a certain type to appear as confident, you wouldn't be right. going around getting plastic surgeries.
Right.
It's your nose, right? So I think I'm just having a really difficult time just even processing that it's a thing. And I didn't know, and I'd like to educate myself more. But I mean, if a white girl shaves off half her hair and dyes the other half pink, she may very well have a problem, but nobody will make a peep if she does much of anything else.
Right.
African American women should have the same amount of freedom. That's it. Like, there's, I don't think that that's very hard to understand. And there's no denying that Black women are forced to self-edit, especially in the professional setting, right?
Definitely.
So, Kim, in terms of, if you look at corporate America, what should be happening right now to bring about this change?
Well, I think the great starting place is the legislation, because mm-hmm. unfortunately, you cannot change a heart, right?
Right.
But you can change your behavior. And so the legislation forces people with those intents of the heart to be accountable when they manifest them.
Hmm.
And I think accountability is what's going to be really important in those spaces.
Hmm.
Because the reality is that people may never change the way that they think.
Hmm.
You know, these types of ideas are very, very ingrained. I mean, even as we spoke in the last segment about people listen to and believe those who are closest to them. Hmm. And so what it takes, the time that it takes for you to undo the idea of that's been ingrained in you over decades by people that you love is a very hard thing to do. At the same point, especially if you're not willing to do it, right? If you don't see the point in it and you're not willing to do it, then it's impossible.
Hmm.
But if the law or the legislation makes you do it, then you might grumble about it, but you have no choice but to succumb to what the ideal is. And so I am really happy, you know, for states like California and New York that have already put legislation in place, and the other states that are following them, you know, like New Jersey and Tennessee. It's really great that the message has reached, you know, those houses, those mayor's offices, and, you know, those state houses enough that they finally decided that this is not acceptable and we need to put these things in legislation to give Black people some backing to stand on in this regard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really commendable that, you know, our state leaders are finally seeing that that's something that needs to be done for their constituents.
Right. Now, Kim, let's talk about your own personal experience. I know you wear your hair natural, right?
Yes.
You don't apply all those harmful products and all that stuff. And I think one of the things that caught my eye when I first met you was exactly that. I thought it was magnanimous. When I saw you, I was like, oh my God, she has such a great personality, right? Was you're welcome. Was that always the case with you? Or did you have to transition to this? Was it a different reality a couple of years ago?
Oh, man, it was definitely a transition. You know, once again, you know, coming from a mother who is from Jamaica and my father from down south. And so those ideas around colorism were very, very heavily steeped into their culture. And so, you know, even as we were preparing for this podcast, I was reminded when I was a child, my mom, she used to always straighten my nose. My mom would always pinch my nose to straighten it because the idea was that a straighter nose is a more acceptable nose. Now, I don't know if it ever worked. I think, you know, the result has been that I love the nose that I have. So shout out to my mom. God rest her soul. But
Kim, I have a confession. I have a confession to make here. So I don't know what's with mums doing that, because my mom used to do that to me and my grandmother used to do it to me. Yeah. I think I have a decent nose. I've never felt the need to alter it. And quite frankly, when I see images of rhinoplasties and all that stuff, I cringe, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I would never take that route. But I never understood why they were doing it to me, so much so that as you were talking about it, I was pinching my own nose. And I'm like, how did she know that I was doing it? Not because I want to like change my nose, but just because it's like a habit now.
Right.
Right. So anyway, I just always interrupt with something silly.
Lines.
Yeah.
As long as I can remember, I think I must have been in like second grade, which is like 7 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And my grandmother would like religiously take me to the hairdresser, and I am really, really exposing myself right now. Girl, this is how you know that I love you.
Aww.
And I had what they called a Jerry curl. Now, in the Black community,
right,
when you say Jerry curl, like this is from the 80s, every Black person that you say Jerry curl to will automatically laugh. And the first image that would come to mind is Coming to America with Eddie Murphy and the scene where his girlfriend is about to marry a different guy and his whole family is the Soul Glow. Like they're in charge of this. They own this company called Soul Glow and their hair is like curly, but the curls are kind of looser than what is natural, you know, natural Afro textured hair.
Mm-hmm.
And because of all of the chemicals and the products you have to use to maintain it, when the guy's mother and father and grandmother got up out of their chair, there was like this big greasy circle where their heads were.
Yeah.
And that was the transition from, you know, the 70s where, you know, I'm Black and I'm proud and, you know, wearing an Afro was the thing. And that was a sign of solidarity in the Black community, especially around civil rights. And then there was this transition into this Soul Glow, you know, carefree curl thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had that up until I was like maybe 11. And then, you know, kids started to call you like Jerry Curl Juice and all kind of crazy.
Oh my God. I have never heard of this.
Yes, I'm telling you, it was a thing. And so at about 11, that is when I went to my grandmother and I said, hey, you know, I'm tired of the kids making fun of me and I want a relaxer. And so from 11 all the way up until I was in my 30s, my early 30s, I had a relaxer. Like I never, from 7 up until when I went natural, I never knew what my natural hair texture was because it was always being manipulated by a chemical process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one day I said to myself, you know, like really, like I don't even know what my natural hair texture looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me go through this process. And I started to grow it out. I started to grow the chemical out of it. I started to do more research into, you know, the dynamics of my natural textured hair, what products are best for it, how to maintain it in its natural state. And I also learned about the health challenges like fibroids and ovarian cancer mm-hmm. that have been linked scientifically to the chemicals in hair straightening chemicals. Mm-hmm. And I made a decision from that day forward that I was never going to go back again to chemically straightening my hair.
I mean, Kim, I can't even imagine you without your afro.
Yeah.
I just can't. Like, I'm trying really hard right now as you're talking and you're describing what you used to do, but I just cannot. And Kim, I mean, one, I'm so proud of you for that.
You
know, you are so beautiful. When I first met you, I genuinely thought you were like 27, 28. And then you dropped this huge bomb on me about like that you have 6 kids and you're stunning. I wish I looked half as good as you. But Kim, one question that I have is that when you finally made this transition, was there a change in how people responded to your new hair? You know, not your new hair. I mean, because that's your natural hair.
Right.
But how did your kids respond to it? How did people in your community respond to it? What was that like?
The response to me deciding to wear my hair in this natural state, every time that I even think about it, every time that I talk about it, it makes me really emotional because although some of the response I could have predicted, most of the response I could have never predicted.
Really?
And so every time I think about it, I am in awe, you know, and as we were talking about before, you know, even in preparation, I did not know how much pride it would give my children for me to decide to wear my hair in my natural state.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have 3 daughters and 3 sons and my daughters are older and then my sons come after. And as my girls were younger and I would braid their hair and put, you know, beads and decorations in their hair, I would straighten it sometimes for them thinking that, oh, that's what they would want to do because at that time my hair was straightened. And after a while and watching kind of some of the damage that happened to especially my oldest daughter's hair, I decided that I was only going to straighten her hair on occasions. And so most of the time I would keep her hair braided.
Mm-hmm.
And literally when I decided to keep my hair natural, I would notice that my children, I mean, you know, so what's crazy now, think about it. Even this past Mother's Day, my children, they gave me Mother's Day card.
Mm-hmm.
And my youngest girl, who's 19, in her card, she thanked me for the fact that I am the reason why she loves herself and why she loves her hair and why she loves her blackness. And I was not expecting. I was so, you know, I mean, kids can say a lot of things about moms and what they do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the role that me embracing my own identity and my own authenticity for myself, it really had a trickle effect on my children, so much so that even my sons are growing their hair and are proud to wear their afros and, you know, not going to barbershops, which is a blessing, bittersweet sometimes in terms of maintenance. But the fact that I did something for myself that had such far-reaching implications on my children. And even as I would walk down the street, and when I do walk down the street, you know, I would just see people take notice of my hair and just kind of like smile as they walk past me in a, like with this smile of approval, you know, or like these small head nods. And I never intended for my hair to be such a symbol and a statement of self-love. But, you know, these many years later, I would never go back. I mean, even now, I don't even like blow dry my hair. I don't think I've done it for like a whole year now. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful to be that, you know, I'm grateful to be that representation, you know, of what it means for we of the diaspora to really love who we are in our natural state.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a lump in my throat as you were sharing your, you know, story about how your kids gave you a card. And I remember you told me that one of your daughters is really good at sketching and you noticed a change in how she was sketching women after you decided to wear your hair naturally. What was that all about?
Definitely. She loves fashion. Mm-hmm. And so she would draw sketches of her outfits and, you know, her models. And I noticed that as I made that transition into wearing my hair natural, when she would come to me to show me her sketches, it would be these beautiful, you know, black women with all of this voluminous hair, you know, curls everywhere. And once again, I started to realize what people project is based on their identity from the inside out. And so what it means to transition to a place of self-love, it's going to ooze out of you everywhere that you go and every way that you present yourself. And so that started to manifest itself even in her art and in her fashion. And that really meant a lot to me in terms of what it meant for her to realize that she, as a black young lady, is beautiful and acceptable the way that she is, and she doesn't have to assimilate into another culture in order for her to be beautiful and accepted.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, has there been any effort to sort of revive natural Afro hair through, you know, hair care products for the black, you know, the black community, products that actually are well suited for their hair and are good for their hair? Because I now feel like there's just so much difference between even the types of curls that you have. I mean, I was so surprised when you told me that you had a specific type of curl and that curl was perceived a certain way. But then if you have a looser curl, then that is considered better. Right? If your curls were not as tight. So what do you think that there now is an effort from the beauty industry to help revive natural hair?
Definitely. I think that frustration, once again, with there being kind of this one type of product in the market was the catalyst for. And I mean, I think, you know, shout out to YouTube, right? Because the whole idea of what it meant to be a YouTuber just really was a fire underneath those efforts to create more diversity and inclusion in what it means to manage beauty, you know, beauty and hair care. And so, you know, it really started with women, you know, creating their own products, doing the research for themselves and figuring out, you know, what types of oils and different things that are best suited for Afro textured hair. And, you know, doing tutorials and videos and all these different types of things. And, you know, in a few of these efforts by these young ladies actually turned them into multi-million dollar corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that, you know, mainstream hair care products had to take notice. And then you started to kind of see the advertisements for their spinoff on, you know, what black women did out of a means of necessity. And so it's, you know, at the end of the day, right, everybody responds to green, you know, regardless, we're having all these conversations about race, which are really important. But at the end of the day, green is what everybody responds to. And so when these major corporations really started to notice, you know, how much money was being spent by African Americans and those in the African diaspora on hair, you know, they jumped on that bandwagon and they started to create their own kind of spinoff of these products. And so, you know, it's been a really monumental shift in the way that Black hair care and the money in the Black hair care industry, which is billions of dollars, like literally billions of dollars Black people spend every year on hair care. And it caused, you know, those other entities to start to really notice and want to jump into that pie.
Right. And I mean, it reminds me of the Madam C.J. Walker docu-series on Netflix. If you guys haven't already watched it, please check it out. Yeah, I mean, man, I just never really thought that this would be such a layered discussion, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
But I feel like we can literally have four separate episodes on each aspect, which we potentially, I think we will. I hope we do. So, all right. So guess what, Kim? We are close to the end. I'm sad.
I know. This has been such a great episode.
I know. So, Kim, as you know, the last section of this podcast is always dedicated to advice, sharing advice, wisdom, knowledge, right?
Sure.
Now, question to you is, what advice would you give non-Black, I mean, I'll divide this into two sections. So let's just stick with part one, which is what advice would you give non-Black folks in context of the freedoms of Black people being able to wear their hair in the traditional way? What can they do?
I think introspection is always important. And what it means for us to examine ourselves and our biases is a work that happens in a room when we're by ourselves and we're left with our own thoughts and our own perspectives. And so part of conversations that you and I have had, even, you know, in the space of appropriation, is it is very clear that other cultures and societies definitely appreciate the contributions of African Americans to the society. The challenge with that is not wanting to respect them as your equal in the midst of those contributions. And so, for instance, when we were planning this podcast, we were having conversations about like Bo Derek, right, from the 70s and her movie 10. And there was a controversy that happened a few years back with Kim Kardashian, where she had put her hair into some cornrows and she posted on her social media saying that she had Bo Derek braids. And there was like this really huge uproar on social media and in the media in general, because those braids that she was calling Bo Derek braids, attributing it to this white actress, were actually cornrows, what we call cornrows, and they are very much a part of African culture and the culture of African diaspora. And so even when we're talking about, you know, big lips, right, big butts, right, all, you know, all these different attributes, physical attributes that are usually attributed to Black women naturally, and yet you see people of other cultures going to other countries and spending multiple thousands of dollars in order to get these same attributes, and yet when a Black woman has them, they downgrade them for having those attributes. And so I really, you know, we talk about Martin Luther King and the fact that, you know, he talks about the world that he would like for his children, you know, to one day be able to take advantage of, where they're judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. And I'm hoping that even from listening to this podcast and as we, you know, continue to sometimes have these segments, really allow people, there's nothing wrong with admiring or giving people credit for something that they have. I feel like every single one of us is made to be special in our own right. You know, we're unique. Every single individual is unique in their own right. There's something that you have, there's something that you do, that the Creator has made you to have and do and be, that nobody else on this planet can have, do, or be, regardless of their color, the color of their skin, regardless of their height, regardless of their weight, regardless of whatever.
Right.
And so I feel like, you know, as we start to take more pride in where we are and how we fit into that puzzle, then we allow other people who have different strengths, right, and different weaknesses come alongside us in the in those puzzles, then that's what makes the picture more complete.
Right.
And, you know, are characteristics that we naturally have that we really can't do anything about outside of plastic surgery and manipulation that takes money is not a threat mm-hmm. and should not be seen as a threat to anybody because they're different, especially if we really want to believe that America is a melting pot.
Right.
And so I feel like, you know, the conversation always starts internally with, you know, what are your beliefs? What are you thinking? Why are you thinking that way? What are you feeling? Why are you feeling that way? Is your projection to somebody else, you know, is it really a mask for an internal inferiority complex?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, then that needs to be addressed instead of purported onto somebody else when they didn't do anything
right
to warrant it.
And now if we, you know, address the other end of the spectrum, which is, you know, in terms of, you know, giving advice to Black men and women who can at least try to break out of this rut to constantly meet American and European standards of appropriateness and beauty. Do you have some concrete pieces of advice for them?
Definitely. Definitely. Please. We need to stop the colorism. We need to also do self-examinations about our history and our internal perspectives on light being right, white being right, lighter skin being better, you know, less curly hair being quote unquote good hair, you know, and when, you know, more coily hair is seen as being bad hair or quote unquote nappy hair. Those are things that we also have to address within ourselves and be happy with what the creator gave you. You know, if your hair is more coily than somebody else's, that doesn't make you wrong. That doesn't make you bad. That doesn't make what the creator has blessed you with wrong or bad. There's a way for you to work it, and you better learn how to work it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because everything that the creator has blessed us with is good and is beautiful. And you just have to figure out where you fit into everything and rock with that. And so I feel like, you know, even in this day and age when we're having conversations, you know, I did a live video rant the other day about, you know, we're talking about, you know, reparations, which definitely people of African descent are owed. But then the question becomes, you know, what are the psychological barriers to being able to take, you know, benefits or sums of money and to be able to put them towards the growth of your community and the growth of your family and your personal growth versus investing those things in temporary satisfaction or temporary fixes that you'll look and then they're gone because you haven't made peace with certain things inside of yourself and fixed those things for your own benefit and for the benefit of those around you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, you know, want to say to people of African descent and the diaspora, you don't have to be a victim to what's been done to you. You are in full control of your story, and you are in full control of bouncing back from the trauma that's been inflicted on you in every form that it takes, whether it's a financial form, whether it's a physical form, whether it's around beauty, whether it's around, you know, relations with other African Americans, whether it's around relations with white people or people from other cultures, you know, we are in a place now where we can take responsibility for our internal condition and make it better. And when you fix the inside, by nature, the outside will also glow.
That was really powerful. Kim, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with all of us. And you are always dropping these incredible knowledge bombs. And I'm ever so grateful for the amount of time you invest in collaborating with me on these super nuanced topics. There is no running away from the fact that in the Western world, Afro-textured hair has historically been treated with disdain by members of all ethnicities, including my own. So this is not about hair, really. This is about race. And, in, you know, so many different people have tried to exclude Black people from public life without having to declare their bigotry. And I think that's really unfair. So why are we talking about this today? Why does Black hair specifically deserve to be a topic of political discussion and subject to legal protection? because for centuries, black hair has been a topic of political discussion and several times under attack by legal systems. Their gravity-defying hair is unique, oftentimes misunderstood, and when left in its natural state, it stands out and it stands up. Black hair is political. A huge shout out to everyone who took the time to tune in today. I'm ever so grateful for your support, and I always want you to know that. Well, thanks again, and I'll see you again next week. Yeah.